Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomer Bob Berman is back to answer all your astronomy questions. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine, and the author of a lot of books. The new one, which will be out in February, is entitled Earth Shattering. If you have a question about the sun, the stars, gravity, the moon, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. He is ready to take your calls, which we will do right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We welcome back astronomer Bob Berman today. Bob is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. His most recent book is going to be turned into a Dutch coffee table book, believe it or not. But the new one, timed just in time to miss your holiday shopping in February, is Earth-Shattering, and that will be out soon. The publicity machine is ramping up for that one. Bob Berman is always a favorite guest here. It's best to call with your questions early, 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy-related question for Bob to ponder. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, you excited for the new book?
Yeah, I am.
It's Earth-Shattering, right?
It is, yes. It's about disasters, cataclysms in space and on Earth over the centuries.
This is exciting. And you had mentioned to me right before we went on the air, Zapped, which was your last book, right?
Yeah.
That is going to be turned into a coffee table book in Holland.
In Holland. I saw the title. It's so big. It's almost like the way the Germans are, you know, where the translation is huge.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's exciting.
Yeah, I like Holland.
Well, very good. And there'll be pictures and everything else?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're doing a whole new, they're adding to the illustrations that are in the original Zapped. And this publisher has a history of doing very fancy, glossy, colorful, great illustrations. So I'm looking
Will you get a copy?
Yeah, sure.
That's great. Sure. And how many languages are your books translated into?
Well, different books, different amounts, but all told, I've got shelves in Korean and Chinese and Czechoslovakian and French and all over the place. Yeah,
oh, that's terrific. Yeah. Well, there is some news, obviously some things in the heavens going on this month. There's a comet, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's probably the most exciting thing for sky watchers, because we don't get bright comets very often. I mean, in all the years I've been living up here, 45 years, there's been two.
Yep.
We probably, everybody remembers Hale Bopp from the mid-90s,
yep.
96. And then there was one 20 years earlier that was Comet West in 1976. So they come about that often.
What about Kohoutek?
Oh, that was 73. That was a
a bust.
Yeah, it was a bust. And, and busts are more common, unfortunately, because we always know where a comet will be, but not how bright it's going to become, because the volatiles in the coma and in the nucleus, as a comet gets near the sun, it starts outgassing. It creates usually a tail of water vapor and plasma, and the charged particles. But you never know how much activity it will have. And this one, Wirtanen, is particularly puzzling, Ray, because it's been discovered way back in 48. It goes around the sun only once every 5.5 years. So it's not like Hale-Bopp, which has an orbit, if I remember right, of about 100,000 years. It's not like Halley that comes around every 76 years. That's 5.5 years, so you'd think this is an everyday comet. But it so happens, although it has the potential to come close, it has not come close since its discovery. So this, and it's next weekend, we're talking about the 15th and 16th, it will come to the closest to the sun and the closest to Earth that it's ever been. But because it's a tiny comet, it's only about 0.5 mile wide, the nucleus, nobody really knows how the volatiles are going to react. Is it going to be bright? It'll be naked eye. Well, I've been watching it the last few nights through binoculars.
Yeah.
And it's bright through binoculars, but not yet visible to the naked eye. Will it attain naked eye visibility? I think so, but there's a difference between a bright naked eye comet with a nice tail and just a barely visible blob. And we still can't say which it's going to be, but we can sure tell people where to look.
And where is that? The sky?
Yep.
Right?
People who know a little bit more than that who can find the Pleiades.
Or right.
The
sure.
Which you can.
Sure.
The Seven Sisters star cluster. It's going to be right there next to the Pleiades next weekend. Not this weekend, but the weekend of the 15th and 16th. Right when it's closest to Earth and the sun, it'll be next to the Pleiades.
Mm. And so you think there's a 50-50 chance we'll be able to see this with the naked eye?
I think so, especially away from the lights of Albany. If you get out to the country a little bit, I think it'll definitely be there. Meantime, every night at about 10:30, on a clear night, if you just sweep with binoculars, these nights it's way below the Pleiades. So you just sweep the sky with binoculars, look way below the Pleiades until you find a big bright blob, and that's it.
Very interesting. Now, which one was actually decent to see with the naked eye? Was that Hale-Bopp?
Hale-Bopp.
That was
beautiful.
Very impressive.
Yeah, that was for a whole year it stayed bright. That was an extraordinary comet, the brightest one certainly. Comet West was a little less bright in 76. Comet Halley was a bust in 1985,
sure.
In the fall of 85. And we've had a number of just barely there comets, Comet Beryllium, Comet Araki Alcock. And if the names don't ring a bell, it's because they were barely there.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Kohoutek. So we can, and then there have been some real busts, like Comet Ison a few years ago.
We talked about that on this program.
I know, and some were predicting it would be the comet of the century. It would be best seen from the Southern Hemisphere. And we had 110 people sign up for our Chile tour that year to see it.
Oh, boy.
And it's good for us, for the tour company, because we got a big crowd, and they loved the Atacama Desert, and they loved the Southern Hemisphere. But I'll tell you, the comet was a bust.
Oh, well. You know, this 5.5-year orbit is strange, isn't it? I mean, that's fairly close.
It is fairly close. But the thing is, every 5.4 years, to be exact, when it comes closest to the sun, which is perihelion, it's very near Earth's orbit. The question is, when it gets to near Earth's orbit, will Earth be in that part of
right.
its orbit?
We should be able to predict that.
And this time we will. It's only going to be 7 million miles away, which is nothing. This is Venus is 26 million, Mars is 34 million. So a fraction of the distance to the nearest planets.
Now, to put this in perspective, what is the orbital year for a planet, let's say Jupiter? How long does it take
Jupiter's
to go around?
11.86 years.
So this is closer than Jupiter.
Yes.
I mean, its orbit is within that of Jupiter and beyond that of Mars.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Are there more out there in that short orbit?
Yep. There's another five-year comet, NK. I have never seen a good apparition of comet NK, E-N-C-K-E. So there are short period. Actually, any comet with an orbit of less than 200 years is considered a periodic comet.
Mm-hmm.
Like Halley was the first of the periodic comets. And then you get comets that have orbits of 150,000 years. And essentially, it's the first time so far as we're concerned. Only when we calculate the orbit do we realize, hey, this is a recurring comet. It's a closed loop. It's not a hyperbola. It's really an ellipse.
Mm-hmm.
And then we figure out, but it's a 200,000-year. So, you know.
Notes now, basically. Bob Berman is our guest. Let's get a call in here before our first break. The number is 800-348-2551. Tom in Saratoga Springs. Tom.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good.
Hello. Hey, Ray, you're one of my science superheroes. I really appreciate your encyclopedic knowledge and your deep understanding of all the stuff you do. It's really, really encouraging and pleasant to listen to.
Well,
you
I'm
talk.
Glad you never saw my grades. That's all. But thank you for that, Tom. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And obviously, we're astronomy is such an interesting subject. I saw on TV the other night, was just slipping through, that a bunch of stars have what they refer to as super Earths, you know, Earth, planets that are two or three or four or five times the size of Earth, but we don't have any of in our solar system. And they kind of went through and postulated that there were a bunch, but they all kind of crashed together. And I've just wondered what if you'd known about this and what you thought about it.
So you mean rocky planets that are much, much larger than the Earth?
Correct.
Okay, Bob.
What do you mean, Bob? He's asking you.
No. I'm off the clock now, man.
I'm just chopped liver. He's saying Ray. You hear?
What's the question?
Right. Do you want Ray or Bob? He wants Ray.
Let's have Bob do it.
Well, Ray. Ray, I'm asking you about Bob. I'm sorry.
Ask Bob because you know I'm just the host of the show. Yeah, that's a good plan. Bob, go ahead.
All right. The answer to that is I don't know.
Oh, well, I could have done that. Papers, scrapers. What do you mean you don't know?
Well, super Earths, you know, back in the early solar system, it was like the Wild West. Orbits, there were a lot more things. Objects crash into other objects. We now know that the outer planets like Uranus and Neptune started out in a very different place from where they are now. There was a lot of influence. In fact, such influence is still going on. It's calculated that eventually Venus and Mars will shift position, and Venus will get closer and closer to Earth thanks to the influence of distant Jupiter. So all of this it's not over, but in the early solar system, it was so extreme, and that's one reason we have the asteroid belt, because we had a bunch of objects that were too close to Jupiter to ever coalesce into a planet, and so they remained as separate chunks, and that's why the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, as you know, Ray, we talked about this before the show, is landing there. Well, it's not. It's eventually it's going to pick up a little material from there to find out what this stuff is made of.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that.
And all of this has to do with the early solar system and how that relates to now. So your news, the caller's news, which is that there were larger Earth-like planets that are no longer around.
Well, he's saying around that have been discovered around other star systems.
Yeah, but didn't he say that they were found?
He was wondering why they weren't in this solar system.
Well, you can't.
They were in this solar system, and they all crashed together, and so they're postulating that that we should have had those same type planets, but there was a mechanism by which they were.
Well, I think Bob sort of mentioned one there, and that is the gravitational pull of Jupiter, and that's why we have the asteroid belt.
That's right. That's doing a lot of things. Things are influencing each other. We even see it today, and it's fascinating. For example, you have Neptune and Pluto. Pluto is, of course, demoted from planetary.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, if you look at a map, it looks like Pluto crosses the orbit of Neptune.
Yeah.
But it's so inclined that it can't cross. But listen to this. As Neptune goes around the sun three times into the second,
yeah,
Pluto goes around twice. Ooh. And so they influence each other in a way that prevents them from ever being close to each other. Do you know that the closest
Hold
planet-
that thought for just a second. No, Zach the engineer is shaking his head.
Okay.
We're 2 minutes, two minutes and 45 seconds beyond our break.
Okay.
So let's take a quick break. Bob Berman is our guest. He's jazzed up today, folks. We'll take a break. We'll be back. All right, now Zach the engineer can calm down. We've done our break. It's 800-348-2551. Vox Pop is the program. Bob Berman is the guest. We talk astronomy today. And Bob, this one came in via email from David. And David writes, if we presume that the universe is infinite in size and infinite in age, and that the Big Bang was a local and recent event, this means there is an infinite amount of mass outside of the visible universe. Would this not explain the acceleration of galaxies? I read it, but I have no idea what
read. The caller is suggesting that the acceleration is due to stuff being kind of sucked outward rather than an expansion of space, which is what we believe. We believe now that empty space has an anti-gravity quality, has a repulsive quality. Sometimes that's called vacuum energy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's called dark energy.
0 point.
And it's called 0 point energy, a slightly different quality to 0 point energy. But all of that amounts to a repulsive feature of empty space itself, which is making clusters of galaxies expand. The caller is suggesting that the clusters of galaxies are instead expanding because there's so much stuff beyond what we can see that it's kind of yanking on everything that we can see and pulling it outward. It's an interesting concept whether the universe beyond the observable universe is infinite in extent. It's possible. You can't prove infinity, but the results from that Berkeley study a few years ago, I think it was in 2013, of 980,000 galaxies, show that space, right up to the limit of what we can see, which is 13.8 billion light years, has a flat topology.
Yeah.
And it could only have a flat topology if the stuff beyond the barrier, beyond what we can ever see, is vastly greater than what we can see. So this also goes along with the caller's idea that maybe the universe is infinite. So infinity has not been disproved. You can't prove it, but it's not been disproved. So let's say it's infinitely large in extent. Well, then, if the amount of galaxies per, let's say, cubic measurement of space, per cubic light year of space, is the same everywhere, that's a big gift. But let's say it continues onward with what we see in the visible universe. That means that an infinitely large universe has an infinite number of galaxies.
Right.
In it. And an infinite number isn't just a very large number. Infinite is something else entirely.
Well, I don't think anybody can even really truly imagine what infinity is.
I can't.
It's beyond our capability.
I sure can't.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We go to Lynn in Chatham. Lynn.
Okay, in a lighthearted mode, two things. The universe isn't the only thing that's expanding over time.
Okay.
I think of our corporeal.
Right. No, I get what you're saying, especially with the holidays.
Yes, exactly. And then the other lighthearted idea is, where did the expression "the moon is made of green cheese" originate?
Ah, well, that's great for our astronomer. Where did the
phrase? That's okay.
The green cheese.
Make something up.
Well, thanks, Lynn. What do you think?
Well, the moon is made of cheese. That's a good idea. Maybe
green
cheese.
Yeah.
Is that what
green
they say?
Cheese.
Green
yeah.
cheese?
Well, I don't know why. It doesn't
even
look
though
green.
It's not green
right.
in appearance.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question.
You didn't hear that? Oh.
You didn't cover that in astronomy school?
No, I've heard the expression like the rest of us, but where does it start? I mean, what it was really believed, the moon was believed to have a surface that had oceans or lakes on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everyone believed, that those dark blotches that we see are oceans.
Right.
Cheese? I don't know. Maybe someone can look it up.
All right. Well, thanks, Lynn. We appreciate that one. Over to George in Stanford. George.
Yes. Hello. Hi, Bob. You've helped before with the beyond biocentrism. So this is another question sort of difficult to ask even. We're comforted by being told that we can escape to Mars at one point if our species needs to. On the other hand, what about the fact that our Death Star, I just heard on BBC, they have a wonderful series about the sun and this probe that's going there. Our Death Star, when it does die, or as it's dying, it's going to subsume all the planets in our solar system because of its expansion. And what about humanity and species beyond just not just human life, but what do you think about the distant future? I mean, an asteroid could come tomorrow and cause a mass extinction, but when they talk about the sun's death and it's going to kill everything in its path, how should we prepare? We stop having children?
Oh, boy.
Let's put this in perspective. Anyway, the sun is good for another 1.1 billion years of giving off relatively the same heat that it is today. Then all calculations show it will be too hot and Earth will no longer be a habitable planet.
Okay.
This is way before it starts expanding to be a red giant. That's another 4 billion years beyond that point that the surface goes outward and maybe even subsumes our planet Earth. Mm-hmm. But the caller is not correct in saying it'll subsume all the planets. It won't. In fact, when it gets to the point where it subsumes Earth, that the red giant is so that Earth is orbiting maybe just inside the sun's photosphere or maybe just outside of it, Mars should then be a place that might be as comfortable as Earth is now. Huh. So Mars remains something for the future. Until then, I'd put no stock in Mars at all as like spare real estate for us to go to because it has no air. Or let's be specific, the air on its surface is the same thinness as our air on top of Mount Everest, but 30 times less.
Mm.
Imagine 1/30th the atmospheric pressure on top of Mount Everest, and that's what you've got on the surface of Mars. So Mars is not an easy, friendly, or inexpensive place to colonize at all. I mean, Earth would have to be so messed up before you'd even thinking of going to Mars that put that off for a billion, 1.1 billion years,
okay,
and then maybe it's doable. And between now and then, I don't have to tell you, there's a lot of other things on our plate that is as likely as not to require remediation first.
Without an asteroid strike, I think we stand a pretty good chance of wiping ourselves out at some point, right?
Yeah. I mean, who knows?
God, what a depressing show. Let's go to Jim in North Pownell. Jim, you're on.
Hey, Ray. Hi, Bob. An intellectual storehouse, as always. I just have a very simple anecdote. My grandmother, Genevieve Gould, saw Halley's Comet twice in her lifetime, once as a young girl and once as a very elderly woman. And my favorite spot for viewing celestial things is the top of Petersburg Pass on Route 2, which is easily accessible from Albany.
It's a great spot.
I have witnessed so many, many, many celestial things up there. It's not even funny.
So you're saying it's a dark place, away, shielded from the lights of Albany?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can see the background glow of Albany. You can see the background glow of Pittsfield. But it's a dark, dark place, and it's a great spot to observe things.
I'm writing this down. What did you say? Petersburg?
The Pass, yeah, Petersburg.
Petersburg Pass on Route 2.
Where the hang gliders go in the summer.
Okay, I'm writing this down. That's good to know.
Yep.
Hey, Jim, my grandmother saw Halley's twice, too. Amazing.
Super.
You know, the first time was the summer of 1910, of course. That's when it came in, or was it April? But in any case, it was in the middle of 1910. And then, of course, in 1985, 1986 was the next visit.
Yep, so, and I watched it with my grandmother in the 80s.
Yeah, cool.
Unbelievable.
Well, thanks,
you guys,
Jim.
You're great.
Appreciate the call, sir. Have a good one. And now it's looked like, Doug, it's your turn. Doug in Connecticut. Hello, you're on.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Good.
So going back to the comets, what makes those comets turn around and come back towards the sun?
Well, they just have an orbit. They don't have to really turn around. They have highly elliptical orbits, which means they whip around the sun, a la Kepler's second law. When they're at their closest to the sun, they're going fastest. That's when the nucleus turns from ices to gas, and that's when the tail forms and a big coma forms around the time of its closest solar approach. Then after whipping around, it does what every other planet does. It slows down. It's got a long stretched out orbit, so it's not circular, but it's still a perfectly valid elliptical orbit. Reaches its farthest point, aphelion, in the case of Comet Halley, that's near the planet Uranus. And then, depending upon how long that orbit is, it'll start falling back again. So you can have an orbit of 100,000 years, an orbit of 76 years, an orbit of 5 years, depending on the size of the orbit.
But is there a point at which it gets that it's just like it slows down to a complete stop and then begins to fall back towards the sun? Does the sun have that type of gravitational you know, pull even, you know, even 100 years out?
Yeah. The sun's pull is always going to be acting on it, but it never stops. It's always just going slowly. We do the same thing. For example, we're farthest from the sun around July 4th every year. And at that point, we're moving slowest. And that's why the sun is moving slowest in the sky. And if you have a sundial, the sundial won't show the right time because the sun is not reaching the noon point quite what it should, mostly because of Earth's orbit, Earth going slowest at that time of the year. Conversely, we're traveling fastest when we're closest to the sun, which is the first week of January. Doesn't feel like it, but that's when we're closest to the sun. So we do the same thing. Everything does. Kepler figured that out amazingly and precisely how objects
go back. I'm going back to read my second law of Kepler then. Yeah. Thank you, guys. Great show.
Thanks, Doug. And over to Joanne in Essex County. Joanne, you're on.
Yeah, we were going across the Nevada desert driving east at dawn back in the early 70s, and there before our eyes was a comet on the horizon, and it was just like a painting. It was so clear and crisp. It almost seemed unreal, but there was a comet that week. I was wondering which one we saw.
Now, it depends upon if it was closer to 72 or 76?
No, it's about 72.
72, it could have been Comet Bennett. That was the comet that year, and that was pretty bright. In 76, just before dawn, we had Comet West. That was a mind-blowing comet before dawn. Reached its best on March 7th of that year, March 7th of 1976. But, you may have seen Comet Bennett in the very early 70s.
Yeah, well, I was surprised because you had commented there weren't many bright ones back in that time period, but that certainly was astounding to see that.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. And then a few years earlier in the 60s, we had comet Kayaseki. That was a pretty bright comet. But in terms of a comet that would have dropped everyone's jaw and that would have been visible even from city lights, although Comet Bennett was visible from city lights and marginally so was West, there you'd have to think of Comet Hale-Bopp.
Yeah.
Because that was just brilliant, brilliant comet in 1996.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks, Joanne. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest. Chris in Albany. Chris.
Yes, how do you do? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 15, 20 years ago, I may have my terms mixed up. This could have been a meteor shower.
Okay.
It was huge. Had a Japanese name.
Well, that was,
I was living on the border of town of Pleasant Valley and town of Clinton.
Well, in 1997, we had Comet Yakutake, which stretched across the whole sky.
And that's it was humongous.
And that was a Japanese name, and this was a brilliant, a huge comet, but it was faint enough that it was spectacular for people who lived in the country and couldn't even be seen by people who lived in under city skies.
Ah.
So if you were in a dark site then in 1997, and it was 1997, I'm quite sure you saw Comet Yakutake. That's H-Y. Yak, A-K. So definitely a Japanese name, and that was a great comet that year.
Unforgettable. There was thousands of streaks. Thousands. Hmm. Okay, Yakutake.
Yakutake.
Right. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman is here. We'll be back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. I'm Ray Graff. Bob Berman is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. And Bob, a few emails here, and then we'll do the home stretch. This one is from Dale. How much warning would we have if an Earth-ending comet or asteroid was steaming toward Earth?
That depends on the direction, because you remember in 2013? I remember it was February 15th. Funny that I can be sure of the day of the year, but not the year. We had that great impactor in
Siberia.
In Siberia, in Chelyabinsk. And that gave us no warning.
Yep.
That came in, and it could have been 10 times larger, and we still wouldn't have had a warning. As it was, it injured 1,000 people. And so it depends on the direction. On the other hand, if it's a known object, for example, the comet Swift-Tuttle is a dangerous, perhaps the most dangerous of all objects. It's a comet that has an orbit opposite to our direction in space. So if it impacted us, it could really be a major catastrophe. And that one we would see coming. There's another asteroid called Apophis that will come very close in 2029, and then again in 6 years later, just missing Earth both times. And if it wasn't going to miss Earth, we would see that one coming too. So sometimes we could have years of warning, and sometimes we could have no warning at all.
Years ago, maybe 20, 30 years ago, there was tremendous footage and photographs of comets striking Jupiter. What were those comets?
Yes, that
you said
was
Swift-Tuttle, but it wasn't Swift-Tuttle, was
that,
it?
That was Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9.
That's it. I knew it was hyphenated.
Yeah, Shoemaker-Levy 9. And it broke up because of Jupiter's huge gravity. It broke up into pieces. So you had all the pieces coming in, bam, 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 producing these black spots as Jupiter rotated under those comet impacts. What a thing.
This one is from Lucas, who writes, is it correct that Titan rotates opposite its revolution around Saturn and that it's losing energy? So in theory, it'll end up rotating as much as our moon. Will that affect the orbit? Could Titan fall into Saturn?
Now, Titan's got a safe orbit. If I remember right, it's a 16-day orbit around. The opposite orbit is actually in Triton, of Neptune's moon, Triton, is the major moon in the solar system that has a retrograde orbit. Titan actually orbits in the normal way that is counterclockwise when you're north of the solar system around Saturn.
All right. This one is from our buddy chef, Rick Orlando. He writes, happy holidays. When I listen to you discussing whether the universe is infinite or not, it reminds me that this is the question that always makes my head spin. Well, Rick, I'm with you there. How could the universe not be infinite? Is it in a box? Is it in a teardrop? Unless there are universes within universes, I have a really hard time envisioning anything but infinite. And believe me, he's tried. Have a great day. That's Rick Orlando.
Oh, Rick, we all love Rick. Everyone loves Rick. Unfortunately, this is one of those things, and if we ever, we're going to have a whole hour-long show on the whole quantum universe of how, since a century ago, there's huge parts of the physical sciences that escape our human brain logic system. In other words, logic works a certain way, and nature, in some areas, does not conform to the way our logic works. I'll give you an example of logic. If we were talking about cats and your kitchen, we'd have to say that, and you had a cat, I'd have to say at this moment your cat's either in the kitchen or it's not in the kitchen. Maybe there's a third choice. Maybe the cat's sleeping in the doorway, so it's partly in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Those are the three choices. There are no other choices than in the kitchen, not in the kitchen, or partially in the kitchen. But in the world of both the tiny and the large, that is the quantum mechanical world, things can be in two places at once. Things can act in way, can take paths that we do an experiment and shows that this electron, there are only two paths. It got to its detector, so we knew it completed the path, but it did not take path A. It did not take path B. It did not somehow get there by taking neither path. And it did not somehow split itself up and take both paths. Now, those are the only choices we humans can envision. Choice A, choice B, both or neither. There are no others. And yet, that's what the electron did. Experiments show, because, for example, we know it can't be neither, because if you block them, it doesn't get to the
detector. How do you know it's the same electron?
Because you create an electron, and then there's the detector. There are no loose electrons in there.
How do you know?
You can do it in a vacuum, and there's nothing else that the detector ever detects that day until you send an electron, and it gets
detected. All right, so what does Occam's razor tell you about that?
Well,
what's your easiest response, that there is another path that we don't know about?
That's right, but it's outside of logic. That's my point, that it exists outside of logic.
So when Rick is
talking about the universe as a whole— You step outside of logic, because although he's quite right, you can't picture a finite universe anywhere, because what would that dwell within? What would be outside of the finite universe? You'd be in an infinite series of universes. On the other hand, what he did not mention is that no one can picture infinity. If we say the universe goes on and on in terms of distance without an end,
yeah. He
didn't say it, but he should have admitted that he's equally tormented by that. I sure would be, because you can't get your head around infinity.
Agreed.
There can't be infinity. So either way, here's a place where either eventuality, the universe being finite or infinite, results as a non-starter for our human logic system, which operates, whether we think or whether we speak, it operates with words that are symbols. You know, the word water is not actual water. So we grasp things by giving everything a symbol. And that works for a lot of things. At night, I could say to someone I'm with, hey, pass the salt. They know what I'm talking
right.
about. You know, you don't have to get fancy and say, oh, that's not real salt, it's just the word for salt. No, you know, that would be obnoxious.
Yes.
But here, in terms of the meta-universe, the larger universe that Rick brought up, or the tiny universe of the quantum realm, you're outside our human logic system. And this is new. In human experience. It started about a century ago.
Let's go back to the phones. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551, the phone number. Luis in Massachusetts, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
Yeah, my question is, we know that the shortest day of the year is soon coming. And we would expect that the shortest day of the year, that would be the time when the sun sets earliest. But we also know that the sun is about to set earliest any day now.
Tomorrow.
How come there is this discrepancy?
I know. People always ask that. And I always wish we were having a TV show, because I could make that so clear with a chart. And it may be close to impossible verbally, but I could try. You're right. The shortest day, the fewest hours of sunlight, fewest minutes of sunlight, are on the 21st, the winter solstice. But the earliest sunset is tomorrow.
Mm.
In other words, that's our darkest afternoon. And by the time we get to the 21st, 2 weeks from now, there'll actually be a couple of minutes more of afternoon light. In fact, since afternoon is when all of us are awake and aware of brightness, we're not all up early in the morning. In a real sense, meaning what we perceive in life, the darkest part of winter is actually tomorrow.
Huh.
But why? Why should that be when the December 21st is the shortest day? The only way I can make this without either going on or babbling without a chart is to tell you this. The dates and the times are based on a comparison of what the sun is doing and our clocks. And our clock system only keeps an average for what the sun does, because, as we said earlier in the show, Earth speeds up and slows down in our orbit, and there's another reason for it too, the tilt of our orbit, and that makes the sun sometimes move faster along its path called the ecliptic across the sky, and sometimes slower. So the bottom line is, it doesn't always reach that point in the sky where it's going to set soonest, just at the point where that also happens to be the shortest day. It could be in a part of the sky that hits the horizon when our clocks say an earlier time, even though the actual number of minutes of daylight are at a minimum 2 weeks later. And it all has to do with the analemma. And if you look at a chart showing that figure 8, which represents where the sun is in the sky at the same time every day of the year. So let's say the noonday sun in January and March and September, you'll find a big figure 8 shape It's represented on some globes out in the ocean. They put an analemma in the Pacific so it doesn't bother, you know, representing lands and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So where that eight, where the sun is on that eight, where it first meets your horizon, wherever it's going to be on that shape, where it first hits the horizon as that figure eight moves across the sky,
yeah,
that date will be your earliest sunset, and that's tomorrow.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. David in Cambridge is next. David.
Hi, everybody. As you know, this is David. You just said so. And for the sake of quality and broadcasting,
yes,
I'll have you know I'm talking to you on a rotary dial Bakelite telephone that dates back from the Eisenhower administration.
Tremendous.
It works. My question is, as on your previous show, last time you were on, you spoke about the Big Bang being possibly affected by, I guess I'll call it a collective consciousness or some sort of a consciousness. Not necessarily the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It sounds more like the observer effect. I am getting into a discussion with he's actually a producer on NPR, as to the existence or lack therein of free will. I am arguing that there is free will. He is arguing that there is not, and I am endeavoring to tell him what for. So would you be so kind as to elaborate on that, please?
Well, you mentioned a bunch of things, the Big Bang, consciousness, free will. You brought up a bunch of fascinating topics. I'm one of the very few people you'll meet, other than your producer friend, who is in the no free will category.
Hmm.
I see not the slightest evidence for free will, but I'm not going to even begin to do that here because that requires a little more setup. Feel free to contact me privately or have him contact me privately.
What's your email address, Bob?
SkymanBob@AOL.
SkymanBob@AOL. Bob is one of the last few Earthlings to use AOL email, so
yeah,
good
but,
for you.
You know, we have to where I live because we have so many internet outages, and AOL is the last one that lets you use dial-up.
Well, good for you.
They still keep their modems, their dial-ups going.
SkymanBob@AOL.com. Well, thanks.
So I'll be happy to talk about that. And as far as consciousness and nature, remember it was John Wheeler, famous physicist, the late John Wheeler, who said that no phenomenon is a real phenomenon until it's an observed phenomenon. And since the last century, quantum mechanics has shown us over and over again that an electron or other things we may observe only exists in a sort of probabilistic blurry state until someone makes a measurement, which means an observation. And only then does it snap into existence with some quality like an upspin or a downspin or what have you. So this isn't me or anyone editorializing. There really seems to be a strange and before the last century unsuspected link between the observer, consciousness, and the natural world, where we're linked in some way, and that's the brief Reader's Digest answer. That's all
yeah.
I can do right now.
And so there's no free will.
That's a different subject.
I think you're right, because if I had free will, I'd be having an old-fashioned right now. Delicious.
I like author Schopenhauer, and it was Einstein who loved him. Einstein used to quote from Schopenhauer. He was a 19th century philosopher who liked to say, a man can do as he, that's how they spoke back then, as if women were chopped liver. You know,
right.
He said, a man can do as he wills, but he cannot will as he wills.
Interesting.
So in other words, if you decide you want pizza, you could say, well, yeah, I had free will. I decided I want pizza,
yeah,
and then I went and I got the pizza. There's my free will.
What if you want pizza and you don't get pizza?
But,
that's free will.
But someone else could say, yeah, but how did that idea, I want pizza, arise?
Right.
And then you'd have to admit, you'd think about it and you'd say, well, I don't know. It just popped into my mind. I didn't cause it to arise. The idea of I want pizza just popped in by itself. So if you really look into it, it really seems like, just like thunderstorms form and rainbows form, it seems like our minds act just like our kidneys act. They sort of act on their own.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all I know is I still want an old-fashioned. Let's go to Tom and Gilderland. Tom, you're on.
Hello. Hi, both guys. I got the wind taken out of my sails because I did have that very same question about the winter solstice. As we get closer to it, why is it that the shortest period of the sunset is about 4:19 in the afternoon. I don't quite get that, but I do have this other question that's a corollary to that.
Okay.
As we get closer to December 21st, our Earth is going faster around the sun. I realize that because we're getting closer to the sun. Why is it that the amount of daylight that we use, that we lose each day, is less? It's down to like 1 minute, whereas there are times, other times of the year, when we lose like 3 minutes of daylight per day.
I think the best way of thinking of that is to think of a sine wave. Some of us remember from oscilloscopes and stuff, and I'll bet Ray does, what a sine wave pattern looks like. Yeah. And when you're near the bottom of the sine wave pattern, you're not moving vertically very much. You're mostly moving sideways. So what happens on the solstice is we're at the bottom of that sine wave pattern of daylight. And so the change up or down in terms of daylight is very, very little. We're just sort of, it eases into it and then it eases out of it. And it's only halfway through to the upper curve in the sine wave, which means the equinoxes in March and September, that we have the maximum change in daylight.
Okay. Well, Tom, thanks a lot. Quickly, we'll go over to Brian in Monticello. Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I was talking with my friends about Planet X, which they had little information on. So I tried to, you know, get them up to speed that there are, you know, these comets way out there that are kind of attracting to this one gravitational place that we think Planet X is. And we were just talking about it. And I was just like, man, Planet X kind of needs a better name once it's discovered. And I figured it out. We should name it Pluto. That would mess with Neil deGrasse Tyson the best. And I think that is what you guys should discuss next. Thank you.
Well, we're almost out of time, Brian, but Bob?
let's get current. Planet X was the name for the theoretical missing planet before Pluto was discovered, when it was thought incorrectly that the gravity of Uranus and Neptune were being causing them to move oddly. It turns out they're not moving oddly, and that was a mistake all along.
Okay.
And that there was a hidden giant planet, which was called Planet X. Once Pluto was found and it was realized that, well, it can't be the right, we stopped using Planet X. Nowadays, the missing planet is called Planet 10.
Yeah.
Nobody's calling that
planet. I thought it was Planet 9. I mean,
Planet 9, because Pluto's really not a planet.
Right.
Was it called Planet 9?
I don't know. I know there was a Plan 9, Ed Wood film.
That's
right?
True, I remember that. Well, maybe it's Planet 9, but in any case, that's the name of this very massive planet that would explain the strange behavior of three Kuiper Belt objects that are orbiting the wrong way, and a massive planet far out beyond Pluto could explain it. But that one has the name of the theoretical name of Planet 9 or Planet 10. We'll have to find out what that name is.
Far out, Bob. We are at the end of the program. Well done, sir. And we'll be looking, well, we'll see you before the book comes out, obviously. We'll see you in January, I assume. And the book is out in February.
Yeah.
Good luck. And
thank you.
Do me a favor. If you get the coffee table book from Holland, can you bring it in?
We'll leaf
through it.
Okay.
We'll try to translate it on the air.
Okay.
great radio.
From Dutch.
We can only do better than we've done today. Support comes from Copper Sea Distillery, New Paltz, New York, a farm-to-glass distillery featuring heritage method distilling in New York's Hudson Valley, providing tours, tastings, and more, coppersea.com. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, celebrating 30 years of protecting the land that protects the lake, offering more than 35 miles of trails for hiking, birding, and outdoor exploration, LGLC.org. And Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thank you for the calls and for listening. And thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Your phones were answered by Jesse King. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Jennifer Clare returns. She's in a 2-year orbit, I believe, around this program. She's back on Food Friday with tips and recipes for making soups, stews, and things that'll keep you warm.